Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We are going to talk today about what's been going on in England with Rupert Murdoch and what is the state of our press and what does this represent in our panel discussion today, and we're glad you are here to join us. We are in the studio with Sherry Parks. Dr. Sherry Parks is author of the book. She was on the show for this book, Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture, and is an associate professor in the American Studies Department at the University of Maryland, and we have been colleagues back and forth in the air for a good 15 years or more. Sherry, good to have you in the studio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we're also here with Bob Sonnenby, another old friend who's been on my show many, many, many years, editor of the Daily Howler and commentator for years and years on the media in this country. Bob, good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So, Uncle Rupert.
Let's get the Schadenfreude out of the way, if that's the correct pronunciation.
Yeah, because you would know. I don't know. You went to Harvard. I just went to a little teeny college up in the mountains. So Rupert Murdoch and this whole brouhaha, I mean, the way that press, a lot of the press is playing it, it seems to me, and the media coverage has been to look at this in terms of purely as its scandal, in terms of the horrendous thing they did, which was hacking into this murdered girl's, 12-year-old girl's
cell phone,
thank you, and the implications of wrongdoing with the police and relationships with the police and all that. That what did Rupert Murdoch know? What did his son know? What did they know? How it affects their media empire? But it seems there's an underbelly to this story that we don't talk about a great deal. I mean, it's not being brought to the fore about what this whole empire means, how it's built, which we'll cover some today. I mean, what are your initial thoughts, Sherry?
Well, I think the American media have been, the mainstream media have been very careful to say they did this, and they don't have our ethics to separate themselves from the practices of Rupert Murdoch. First of all, Rupert Murdoch lives in the United States. When right. He came home to New York. He's a citizen. And his influence in the United States is already very widespread. I mean, he owns the Wall Street Journal. I mean, he owns other things. He owns the coupons that jump out at you at the supermarket. He owns that, too. What keeps going through my brain is, you know, that Beyonce song where she says, da-da-da-da, I own it, but I bought it. It's like, you know, I own that. I mean, it keeps coming out. His empire is much broader than we knew already in the United States. And so it does impact us a great deal.
Yeah, and I'd say it isn't just the Murdoch empire, which, of course, is a large empire, but the broader story here involves other media empires and media practices which have been influenced by the Murdoch empire or which even predated the Murdoch media empire and their practices. This is, you used the term scandal, it is in the narrow technical sense a scandal involving alleged conduct which would be illegal, hacking into people's phones. And there's been a lot of Schadenfreude, if that's the correct pronunciation.
What does that mean for
I don't even know.
I do know. It means taking pleasure at other people's suffering.
Right. A lot of people have been...
I'm the professor. You know, that's why you bring me in here. Like, okay. I mean, I'll be quiet now.
especially among liberals and progressives, there's been a lot of sort of street parties going on because we finally caught Al Capone on the tax evasion. Because it's a relatively... Really... The phone hacking, while it's egregious in certain ways, it's a relatively minor offense compared to the larger offenses committed against the public discourse mm-hmm. by the Murdoch empire and other media empires. So it is a kind of a narrow technical scandal, but I think the bigger problem about the Murdoch empire, it's not what the Murdoch empire has really done to media. If all they had ever done is hacked into people's phones, that would be illegal and weird and wrong, but that wouldn't really be a gigantic – that would be a weird practice, not a giant media problem. And there is a giant media problem, and it goes beyond Murdoch.
And I want to go to – go ahead, please.
Well, I just want to say we also should be clear that he owns Fox News.
Right.
And that is,
and the Wall Street Journal.
And the Wall Street Journal. So – and that's a really important aspect to what you were just saying in terms of how some of the press is responding to this. This is a way of getting back at Fox News.
Yes. And we'll come – I think that's a big piece that we can't forget to come back to that kind of mm-hmm. war among the media. The issue that he's directly accused of, or they're directly accused of in England, though, this hacking – has an American angle that I was reading about this morning that I didn't even know about, that Rupert Murdoch owns this company called News America. that has the control of things that pop out at you at the grocery store,
right.
You were talking about,
yes.
Remember? Well, there's another company that was vying for the Safeway contract.
Is this Floor Graphics?
Yes. That now accuses, before this even happened,
2007,
accused the Murdoch company of hacking into their computers to get their information to kill their bid to get the contract that they got.
And they not only accused them, they won a lawsuit. There was a very large settlement, which is the way Rupert Murdoch fixes things. He writes a check. Did you read this? And 2 weeks later, he bought them.
He bought them. Right. He bought Floor Graphics.
Yes.
Yes. Right.
Well, if you're hacking,
which he tried to do in the beginning, but they wouldn't let him. And then he ended up owning it anyway.
And in 2007, and you and I found the same thing, Fortune magazine wrote this.
Right.
We weren't paying attention.
Right.
We, largely.
Because it didn't seem important for some people, I guess. I didn't even know about it.
It's sort of, by the way, if you're hacking into Queen Elizabeth's phone, I don't know why you wouldn't be hacking into Floor Graphics. So let's just say that. I think if you're hacking that far up the ladder, you're pretty much hacking. I'll just guess that you're hacking many places.
And going through trash. I mean, which is
whatever.
Low-tech version of hacking into somebody's phone.
But I'll have to say, part of the reason why people weren't, it isn't like people haven't been paying attention to Murdoch or talking about Murdoch, because obviously Rupert Murdoch has been a huge topic in this country for a long time. But the discussion, this actually is relatively trivial compared to the larger story about what's happened to our media in the age of Murdoch. And I mean, what happened to NBC News in the late 90s and early aughts GE CEO Jack Welch, another conservative, near billionaire, corporate executive who produced a very strange era of news at NBC. Now, liberals have always contended, liberals and progressives have always focused on Murdoch's empire. The Jack Welch NBC empire was relatively less important, but they played a huge role. In my view, no one worked harder to get George Bush into the White House than NBC News under Jack Welch, and progressives have never discussed this. Welch is no longer the head of GE, and they've moved on to a different era. But Murdochism has not been restricted to Murdoch, and he's just a very visible player, highly visible and important.
I think that's why this is really important as a cautionary tale for the United States, because that corporate mentality and its influence on American media has been seeping in, largely unspoken about, because the media would have to cover itself, which it tends not to do at all, not even well. I mean, it's been interesting to watch how some of the implicated members have covered themselves or not covered themselves. This doesn't show up much in the Wall Street Journal. There's a news story breaking about Piers Morgan, which is not breaking on CNN, which we can talk about. 30 years ago, journalism was different in the United States. And I'm not saying necessarily better, but it was different. There was a firewall between the business people and the journalists. And I'm not saying that sometimes somebody didn't cross the aisle and kill a story. I mean, that has always happened. But the power structure, who owns the media, has changed in the last 30 years. So it used to be that if you owned a newspaper, you owned a television station, you weren't going to make a mint. You weren't going to lose your shirt. It was conservative money. People tended to stay away from the journalists for the most part. Now, geopolitical corporations own American media, the GE. Owns NBC. I mean, but somebody else owns almost every mainstream outlet. And the bottom line has changed what we know, how we know, in ways that we aren't sure about. Murdoch, I think, is almost the caricature at this point that can teach us to turn around and pay attention. And then I know, Mark, you've been saying this for a very long time, and your listeners know this, but I don't think middle America knows this. And maybe this is a story that gets their attention.
Because we don't pay attention to it. I mean, or even think, maybe people do, maybe I don't know, but I don't think about that. In a different era, in the 50s, 60s, early 70s, media was locally owned for the most part. Mm-hmm. The New York Times was a national media. Wall Street Journal was a national media owned by people in New York.
Mm-hmm.
But it was international media owned there. The Sun was locally owned.
Mm-hmm.
TV stations were locally owned. And so it was a very different world. I mean, and so people are kind of, as somebody I was interviewing the other day, David Corton on Monday, an economist who thinks the Federal Reserve should, instead of bailing out Wall Street, should put money into building up local banking and credit unions and state banks like North Dakota. I only say that to say, in some sense, it's trying to figure out how to go to an era of local control, which made a difference in media. And I don't know if we can ever get back to that. Maybe we can, maybe we can't. But that's one of the questions I think that people should wrestle with. I mean, how do you control media giants? Is it possible to control media giants?
Yeah, I mean, concentrations of wealth and power obviously characterize the era. And Sherry says something I want to go back to and highlight. She talked about, she said the press corps tends not to discuss itself. Boy, they really tend not to discuss themselves. And that you're going to see that in any discussion, even of Murdoch, who's treated as an outlier among the press. Let me just give you an example of why, just on the level of individual players, people don't like, journalists don't like talking about journalists or journalism. Ed Henry at CNN recently got hired away by Fox. Now, you know, over the past year or so, there's been some complaining by liberals and progressives that the other news entities don't critique Fox as much as they should, and that's probably true. Part of the reason for that, and this affects all the entire empire of news, journalists now are very mobile. They move from one news organization to another. They get paid a lot of money, a good part of which is for compliance. And if you're working at CNN today, you might be working at Fox a year from now with a very lucrative contract. And people, careerist journalists, are not going to talk about what's going on at other news organizations. They don't stay at Time for their whole career anymore. They move around, and the one thing that you see again and again, they put their own careers first. And so there's a very, very stylized way the press corps discusses the press corps. It won't discuss the press corps. It just doesn't do it. And you have to go outside the press corps to get anything like a serious discussion of media practices. It's all fake when the press corps is talking about the press corps.
Maybe that's why I haven't been offered a job anyway.
I think that may, that may well be why.
And one thing to add to what, you know, what we're saying is that the most common form of censorship among journalists is self-censorship. You don't get this drama every day where, you know, the editor or the publisher comes in and says, don't write that, don't do that. Journalists are socialized into the organization, and if they're going to work there for any length of time, they come to know what the rules are. That seems to have happened very much in Rupert Murdoch's situation, where they knew what not to write about. I think that's the case in many news organizations. You just know not to go there or to go there. And that's a very subtle but extremely effective way of controlling people.
I mean, it seems to me that one of the issues here also is that is how Murdoch has always played the game. I mean, if you go back to what you talked about, NBC and
Jack Welch.
Mm-hmm. But Murdoch, who owned Fox 45 and turned it into a very kind of conservative right-wing blogosphere, I think the guy's name was John Ellis, who was then the head of Fox News. During the first election of George Bush, he was also George Bush's first cousin. He ran Fox News, working for Murdoch, was the one who said, Bush has won. This is during the Florida thing. And then the entire media kind of hyped in, yes, Bush has won, in a very excited tone, and started this whole kind of push that kind of very quickly ended the possibility that Gore could win. They won't go back to all that again. But this is that, and so but Murdoch, and we can talk about it in a minute, Bob, if you look at other media who plays that way as well, but Murdoch has played this game over and over again in New York City politics with his ownership of the New York Post and Koch as mayor. Came out immediately to defend Murdoch in New York, as did Klein, who ran the schools in New York.
Who is now an assistant associate of Murdoch's, who was sitting right behind him.
Exactly. He's his top lawyer. Incredible. Really. You know, one of the things about the current Murdoch, technical scandal involved statements of shock about how Murdoch would visit Downing Street and Murdoch would meet with important political figures in Britain. obviously Murdoch was completely cultivating. Here's Joel Klein, who was the head of the New York City schools over the last decade under another billionaire
mogul, Bloomberg,
a very significant figure in American educational discussion over the last year on the side of what's often called corporatist, quote-unquote, education reform. Whatever you think of it, Joel Klein has been a very big player. He was and in the reporting about – well, when he left his post in the New York schools at the end of last year, he immediately went to Murdoch for $4.5 million. And there he was last week, his consigliere sitting right behind him, the most trusted lawyer in the whole stock. And in the New York Times reporting, which was very wide-eyed, they mentioned how Murdoch had been talking up Klein while he was still working in the New York City schools.
And giving him very good coverage in his newspaper.
Oh, they completely pandered to Bloomberg, and so they completely pandered to Klein. And Klein and Bloomberg were caught in a total testing scandal last year when the state of New York threw out all their test scores for years. The New York Times completely chose to treat that like, well, nothing really happened. Look over here. But my point is, obviously, Murdoch isn't just meeting with important political figures in London. He's obviously was cultivating important political figures in New York. Although it's being treated here, like, don't look at that. That didn't happen. What difference does it make? I mean, it's stunning to me that Klein would be his number one lawyer last week. That's just incredible. Out of his whole empire, this is the guy he trusts more than anyone else to advise him at the big hearing. Why? I mean, it's really.
Well, evidently he's become his senior lawyer.
That's what I'm saying.
In a very short time.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. The everyone's acting shocked. My God, he went to Downing Street to meet with high officials. Well, how about what he was doing in New York? Now, it's not illegal to meet with high officials. There's no law about meeting with high officials. But this sense of shock, feigned shock, that it would be happening in London when it obviously happens here all the time.
And that's what's really another part that's really important about the corporate aspect of journalism, not just American journalism, but journalism and the American model, which is what it's called now, is that a reporter meeting with Downing Street or Wall Street, people might look askance at that. But a corporate executive meeting with those people looks like business as normal, even though it may have the same or an even more profound effect upon coverage than the single reporter who does that.
Right.
If that's not too convoluted.
No, it's not. But Murdoch, who also owns HarperCollins,
mm-hmm. Yes.
A huge publishing house. There was a time when Newt Gingrich was in Congress and they were looking at bills legislation around oversight of media and media conglomerates and how they can do what they do. And then he offered Newt Gingrich $3.5 million to write a book.
And people at the time wondered why. Now we can see it.
And he does this all the time. I mean, in England now, all these other publishing houses are coming together to try to counter Murdoch's offer to Tony Blair in seven figures to write his book.
And one of the things that gets mentioned and tossed aside in the way that Bob was talking about is the B Sky B deal. They just say, oh, it fell through, almost if people just said, oh, well, we don't want to deal with him. He was about, this is a satellite company, he was about to get a waiver. Because there's a rule in Britain that's kind of like the rule here that we've scuttled in our own way about how much of the media you can own. And he was about to get a waiver for that so that he could control more of the satellite market in England than the law allowed. They weren't changing so that he could. And that's what got scuttled. It wasn't a business deal that went sour. It was that his waiver went sour.
His waiver went sour. The business on some level would still go through.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if in a few years after this is all settled down that he doesn't end up owning BSkyB again, but not for now.
And they'll go ahead, Bob.
Let me just cite a couple of cases in this country of this kind of interaction between the highest level press players and the highest level politicians, because everyone's shocked to think that Murdoch was socializing with major politicians in England. Where was the late Tim Russert, former head of Meet the Press and basically mayor of the New York of the Washington Press Corps? You know, a very, very influential American journalist over the last several decades. Where was he the night before the U.S. found Saddam Hussein in Iraq? He was at Don Rumsfeld's Christmas party, as he announced the next day in Meet the Press. This sort of thing is normally not discussed, but apparently he just couldn't keep it in this time. It was such an exciting connection. So there is the head of NBC's Meet the Press at the Christmas party of the Secretary of Defense, who he's supposed to be covering. Is that really a way we want our journalism working? Where was Ted Koppel the night before in 2004, the night he interviewed the head of the Swift Boat veterans on Nightline and
Swift
bungled.
Boat.
Yeah, the Swift Boat veterans, the guys who were going after Kerry. The night that Ted Koppel interviewed the head of the Swift Boat veterans, that night, when Nightline was still a big influential program, where was Ted Koppel that night? And by the way, he completely bungled the interview. He was at a testimonial dinner for his friend Colin Powell, giving speeches about how he always takes his new cars over to Colin Powell's house to show him off. I mean, this is just outrageous. And there's all kind. This is never discussed within the press. The press never discusses its own conduct. So this is all tamped down, quieted, hushed up, and occasionally little episodes float up and you learn about them. But this kind of highest level interaction is completely common among our own press corps.
Yes.
It just never gets discussed.
Because yes. Who would discuss it?
But they know right. That they mustn't,
right.
Absolutely discuss. Mustn't discuss it.
Well, I mean, the just before we go back to the take a break here and go back to Murdoch and what's going on with this media empire and how it influences the world and what our analysis of that, especially where it comes to America, I mean, the same stories were at National Public Radio. I remember 10 years ago or so having this huge debate at dinner with a NPR host personality who I won't mention the air, but we had this huge conversation, and I called Dick Cheney some terrible name in our dinner about what he was doing to the country, and he said, "No, Dick Cheney's an honorable man." His response was because he had just gone to dinner at Dick Cheney's house in one of his big wine dinners with these expensive wines and serving immense steaks and, you know, and having parties. And I'm saying, and we had a big guy. Well, should we be at those dinners? Should we be having dinner with the people that we're supposed to be critically covering in America? Is that what we should be doing?
And what did that person say?
Oh, this got nothing to do with it. It was just part of the Washington social scene.
Bob Schieffer moderated one of the Bush-Kerry debates. Very few people know that Bob Schieffer is a personal friend of George Bush. He said once he used to go to spring training with Bush. His brother, Tom Schieffer, was a longtime business associate of George W. Bush and became his ambassador. Nothing wrong with that. But, I mean, the idea that someone who is a personal friend of one of the candidates, who has gone to spring training with him to watch baseball, would then host, moderate a presidential debate, and no one says a word about it. I mean, the agreement in the press never to discuss this is absolutely uniform.
But let me ask two of you this before we go to break here. What does that mean? What that means to the two of you about where we all are. I mean, I have friends who are elected political figures, people I've known before they were elected political figures who've now become elected political figures. I've known for 20, 30 years, even before they became in that position, and they knew me before I was in this position, or people who I've met in the course of my work who I've come to respect and like who happen to be elected political figures. It's a line sometimes that is difficult to draw, and then you have to ask these people that you like on a personal level some very tough questions if you're interviewing them about a specific thing that we'll find tomorrow when we go to Capitol Hill. Some of these congressmen I know before they were elected, they were personal friends, but now I'm in a position where I have to ask them very hard questions about where they are in their deliberations about the deficit. You know what I'm saying, Sherry?
I believe I have heard you say that on the air, that this person is a friend of mine, but... I think one of the things that could happen is what Bob is calling for is disclosure. Is that maybe you can't avoid having friends in high places. I do think that affects coverage. I think it affects the question that you ask. Because we know that if you know somebody personally, I mean, there's all kinds of evidence for all kinds of ways. If you know, this is going to seem to be off topic, but it's not. If you know a gay person, your attitudes about gay culture change. We know that that personalization changes attitudes. So maybe that happens, but maybe self-disclosure is really important. And then maybe if you're a beat reporter, you change beats.
Maybe you do.
Yeah, I'm not, you know.
Yeah, maybe you do.
You can't make laws that people can't know other people or have, the thing I would point to is the agreement within the press corps never to discuss this, not to discuss their wealth, not to discuss how they live, not to discuss who they socialize with. And it isn't just that the individuals don't discuss it about themselves. Everyone else agrees not to discuss it about those individuals because you want to get on Bob Schieffer's show. You want to get on Meet the Press. So if you are a journalist working your way up through the system, you aren't going to say, why was Tim Russert at Don Rumsfeld's Christmas party? Because getting on Meet the Press is part of the way a career is made in American journalism. And there's a tremendous agreement. There's no code of silence like the press corps' code of silence. That's the only thing.
And I don't think that objectivity is humanly possible. But I do think that there was an era where professional journalists strained toward it. They worked for it, or it was enforced. Now there is this cover of objectivity, which, by the way, the audience doesn't believe anymore, when there's almost no pretense of it under the covers.
You listen to the Mark Steiner Show. You just heard Sherry Parks. She is author of Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture, associate professor in the American Studies Department at the University of Maryland, and Bob Summerby, editor of the Daily Howler. We're looking at this Rupert Murdoch case that's still unfolding in Great Britain. But how does it affect us here in America? How does it affect the press? What do global empires and press mean? In the media mean? We'll come back to that discussion and more, how it affects us here locally, how it affects us here in America. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This broadcast of The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Associated Black Charities. Associated Black Charities is a proud sponsor of the Black Male Identity Project. For more information, www.morethan28days.com. That's morethan28days.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're here with Dr. Sherry Parks, who is professor in the American Studies Department at the University of Maryland, author of Fierce Angels, The Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture, and Bob Summerby, editor of the Daily Howler. So as we look at the whole issue of Rupert Murdoch but the larger issue of the press and what it means for us here, there's a way in which Rupert Murdoch and maybe others that Bob will bring out, I'm sure, that in the press have turned in some senses the American public against the press. Tabloid journalism has now become mainstream journalism.
In England, it has always been the case. And so that division that was, I think, maintained in the United States for a long time. I mean, we've always had yellow journalism. I don't want to pretend that the American press has always been like the New York Times or the Baltimore Sun. But there's always been a division until very recently between the two. But now the mainstream press, whether it admits it or not, is reading the tabloid press because they find some of their stories there, particularly the celebrities. And I think part of the thing that we're talking about is that journalists are celebrities. Like it or not, Mark, you are, for Baltimore, a celebrity. But journalists want to have it both ways. And I admit it that I, on occasion, have wanted it both ways, too, where you want to have some influence in your community and you want your privacy at the same time. And that's what I think Bob is describing, is that they get to hide behind this picture of objectivity and being a journalist so that they don't get the same intrusion and perusal that other public figures get.
Yeah, right. They'll discuss conflicts of interest in every other sphere except their own. I mean, that's basically how it works. I would say, you know, in terms of Murdochism, you're talking about the tabloidism. That's one side of the coin. The other side is the right-wingism. So those are two different problems. In terms of the tabloidism, there's no question that the mainstream press corps increasingly is focused on utterly fatuous topics. The mainstream press corps is increasingly fatuous. If you look at the New York Times op-ed page, which is supposed to be sort of the highest platform for American opinion journalism, the just the endless focus on silly the endless focus on silly, fatuous, ridiculous. There were two pieces on Sunday that dealt different ways with Michelle Bachmann. Neither one mentioned that she has said she wouldn't raise the debt limit for any reason. Now, that's a very strange political position. But the one whole column about her dealt with her headaches.
It's just absurd.
Just silly. Every silly thing we've heard. And now, look, the headaches, that could be a medical condition that actually, who knows? It's worth, but it's relatively trivial.
And wouldn't it be a violation of the American Disabilities Act if her migraines are debilitating?
I mean, I'm sure there's someone who has migraines so bad that they could not really serve as president. I don't know. But my point is, a whole column was written about her without mentioning this rather strange political position, but dealt with every kind of trivial thing that she has said. A second column dealt with the debt limit matter and scalded Republicans without naming the names of anyone who has taken this ridiculous position, including the second leading presidential candidate. So somehow there were two columns that appeared. Neither one got around to mentioning the fact that the second leading candidate has taken the position we should never raise the debt limit, which is a very strange political position. The fatuity in the mainstream press crowd, the focus on every silly, trivial, personality matter as opposed to real policy matters is endless. So that's, to the extent that Murdoch is about tabloidism, that's all through. That kind of focus on the relatively trivial is all through the mainstream American press.
And this is why this is a dangerous move. I mean, we all know that the United States is not a straight democracy, but the ideal we're supposed to be working under is that you have a citizenry who has information that they can get to, that they can understand, so that they can make considered and studied decisions and pass them up to their representatives. That is what we're supposed to be doing, right? And I know there's a lot wrong with what I just said, but that's what we're supposed to be doing, right? That's how we're supposed to be playing. This tabloidism, this silliness, this covering things that don't matter undercuts all of that, because now the citizenry does not have the information at this point, this is my opinion, to make considered and studied decisions about their day-to-day lives and to speak to the representatives that are supposed to be representing them. Say they don't have the information anymore. It's hard to get to the information if you're trying to get to it.
Mm-hmm. And if you look at what this world of Rupert Murdoch has done and extrapolate that out to where we are in America now, I mean, across at least three continents, Australia, Europe, and America, he has bought huge chunks of the media world.
Right.
And has cross-pollinated his other worlds.
Does the term geopolitical domination seem too strong a word?
I don't think it is too strong a word here. I mean, you know, when he wants to sell his satellite network in Australia, he uses his power in his ownership of over one-third of the Australian media to say, come here to watch the movies that we have on that are being made by 20th Century Fox that I also happen to own, Murdoch says, and that's what he sells as news story on the front of his newspapers. Or the fact that he's now made a deal with the Chinese government, who he will not criticize at all in his media or allow criticism in his own media, to sell the Titanic to billions of Chinese viewers now. I mean,
the movie, not the ship.
No, the ship, but the movie that 20th Century Fox right. made that he owns. I mean, this cross-pollination, not just cross-pollination, but using his different media outlets to sell to the rest of the world, anything that he owns is not talked about by anybody.
And I keep going back to the Bob example about NBC, because they do that on another level, where the Today Show, which I actually like, and I think that's why they don't get criticized, is that they have a presentation that is moderate to left sometimes. But when they have a book author or they have a movie, particularly if you have a week where they're doing the stars of the same movie day after day after day, look and see who owns that movie. And you'll see that they're actually promoting their own vehicles. It's a smaller scale of the Murdoch.
Right. Same thing.
And, of course, NBC / MSNBC is a completely different entity now than it was under Welch. I mean, under Welch in the late 90s, especially the cable arm, but also Russert, Brian Williams, they were aggressively anti-Clinton and crazily anti-Gore. They spent 20 months doing everything they could to get George Bush into office. You have never seen a liberal or progressive. No, liberals didn't even notice. I mean, literally, the claims were so ubiquitous that liberals didn't even realize how ridiculous the claims were. And by the way, these claims had to deal with why is he wearing earth tones? You know, every kind of talking about the tabloidism, the silliness. Yeah.
Right.
So MSNBC is a totally different animal today than it was under Welch. But that was a second. And it's just, I find it very hard to believe that that was not somehow connected to Jack Welch's personal politics. Now, there's no way to prove that. But he made Chris Matthews a multimillionaire. He put Brian Williams in place to be the Brokaw successor. The whole bunch of them, except for Williams, live out in summer homes on Nantucket with Jack Welch. This is the funniest story ever. The press will never discuss it because you're not allowed to discuss. This is very comical. That to see Russert was out there in a $7 million summer cottage. Matthews bought a $4.5 million summer home on Nantucket, cuddled with Jack at the club. This, by in any other industry, this would be considered the funniest story that ever happened. It isn't. It was discussed in the Washington Monthly, and I'm sorry, in the Washingtonian, as sort of a D.C. insider celebrity magazine once, which is the only reason I know about it, because it's never discussed, and it's hugely comical, and it's a level of corporate interaction with the media stars that's really shocking. We're not allowed to know about it. And they killed. They did everything they could to get Bush into the White House.
And we're picking on NBC, but that's not to say that this has not happened at every major network at some level.
Right.
Donald Duck owns ABC.
Donald Duck?
Disney.
Walt Disney.
Yeah, Walt Disney. I'm so slow. I'm a little slow in the uptake there. What?
Did I miss that?
I mean, but it's also that, you know, you look at people like Rupert Murdoch and what they've done. And, I mean, he has – and again, I know you can extrapolate this out to more than Murdoch. But he uses wealth to kind of take over businesses and individuals, keep them quiet. If they want to damage him or sue him, he pays them off with his multimillion dollars to quiet all the lawsuits around him. His ability and the corporate media's ability to control their agenda on Capitol Hill is huge. He does it in Australia. He does it in England. He does it here in America.
Because Congress needs them to get elected. That's the final piece of the circle that we are building.
So what is that? I mean, where is this taking us beyond this? This kind of watching on, you know, you can sit on Democracy Now and watch the hearings, Murdoch hearings in the parliament.
It takes us to the lunatic place we are today, where in the next week, you talk about, you know, the old show, this was the week that was. I mean, this coming week is potentially the strangest week in American history and one of the most destructive. Now, it may be that they'll come up with some deal. But the lunacy of what's going on right now in that area, just the sheer foolishness of it, the foolishness of the press coverage, the ineptitude of the press coverage. You can't run a press corps on earth tones and headaches and every ridiculous thing matched with every kind of ludicrous right-wing talking point coming from all kinds of major entities like Fox. You can't do that for 15, 20 years and not see your nation dissolve into sheer lunacy, which is where we are today.
Because what happens is that while this was building in Congress, we were paying attention to Casey Anthony.
We sure were.
Because that's where the media – and part of it is the audience's fault, if we want to use that word. The media is responding to it. We respond to what we get. People get personally involved. The media then give us more. And what else happened during those several weeks? I mean, obviously, this conversation about the debt ceiling was happening, but the American electorate were not paying attention, in part because they did not have the front page information to pay attention to it. And that's where we are.
Let me tell you, if you were trying to pay attention in the last month on the debt ceiling, it's very hard to find information. I mean, it's incredible what the New York Times has never discussed. It's incredible. They don't discuss anything. They discuss, what did Boehner say yesterday? Well, then what did Cantor say? What did Jay Carney say? And that's my report. They have made no attempt to clarify. The country is full of people who have been told it won't matter if the debt limit doesn't get raised, blah, blah, blah. I mean, the country is full of people who have been told and believe all the kinds of things you see on Fox. There is no effort anywhere to clarify, challenge, contradict, or analyze, virtually no effort at all. And so you saw two big op-eds in Sunday's New York Times, neither one of which even mentioned that Michelle Bachmann. It's just, there's a complete avoidance of any real discussion.
When it is covered, it's covered in a way that starts to look like maybe either the tabloid papers or the sports page, because it's the Democrats versus Republicans who just scored the point today, instead of what does this plan say and what will that do to you, and what does this plan say and what will it do to you. And I think the American people have just awakened. And if you're in Congress, and I've heard Congress people say this, what you don't ever want to do is to wake the American people up. Because then, you know, we become a wild card, which is kind of interesting in democracy that we're the wild card.
The people are the wild card.
Right. Because usually we're not paying attention. And now people are beginning to say, wait a minute, this will raise my interest rates. This will do this to me. This will take, okay, let's pay attention. But where's the information that they need to make decision?
So is this, when you look at, and I don't want to make Rupert Murdoch the bogeyman of the entire world, but...
And that's why we keep going into other people.
He did not create all of this. Granted, Fox is a nightmare in the United States. He did not create all the rest of this.
But there seems to me a synergy of forces here that's taking place. On the one hand, and maybe I'm just being paranoid here, but on the one hand, you have this over the last 25, 30 years, the consolidation of ownership of media in very small group of hands around the world, Murdoch being one of those hands. But that created this tabloidization of the media where, you know, you used to be that you pay a little bit of attention to the news. The news was on the front page of the Sun. You turned on television and you had three or four channels and you watched ABC, CBS, or NBC News, and it was Walter Cronkite or somebody else. And granted, they were all a bunch of old white guys telling us the news, but there they were, and they were these storied figures who did it. And the tabloids, if you wanted, you were in the supermarket chain, you can pick up the Sun, other Sun, and the other newspapers that gave us the tabloid news, and it was very purient stuff, and you can enjoy yourself and watch it and go off and play with that. But then if you had this central news force, things would erupt and force people to answer questions because there was news on the front page. The reporters were out there on Capitol Hill and in New York covering this stuff and giving it to us every day. So it was there. So you don't have that anymore. So you have this tabloidization of the media on the one hand that kind of gives us this Casey Anthony stuff to play with as headline news as opposed to the dead. And then you have the corporatization of the media where these guys have so much power that they wine and dine the leaders of the world. And it literally affects how the news is reported. So we're not seeing it.
A couple of puzzle pieces to add into there.
Yeah.
Tabloid newspaper is cheaper and easier to give to people because it takes years for a beat reporter to develop a beat, to develop informants, to develop all of that. That takes money, and maybe it doesn't make a great deal of money because it doesn't sell newspapers. Natural experiment. My brother was one of the new black reporters who came of age in the 70s. He went to a historically black newspaper in Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh Courier.
The Courier, right.
And they were about to go sensational. And he said, give me a year. If I don't double the circulation a year, maybe that was hubris, a year. With serious journalism, with making it a better paper, then I will leave. A year later, he did raise the stature of the newspaper. He did increase the circulation. He did not double the circulation, and he left. natural experiment. That happened all over the country with people saying, well, let's try to do a better job at this. What people will buy and easily digest is tabloid newspaper. And what that means is that when you really need the media to do its traditional job, those relationships, because reporters do have relationships with news sources. They just don't, they shouldn't be necessarily at dinner with them,
right.
but they do have conversations with them. A reporter's life now is very different than it was 20 years ago. He or she may be asked to cover a bunch of different things, and so it's very difficult to become an expert in any of those when it comes time to use that expertise, because they're all over the place. There are fewer people in newsrooms now. They just are. And they're pressed in ways that they haven't been pressed before. And so tabloids information is just easy to get because, for one, it's being fed to you by PR people.
Right. And
here's the thing. You mentioned the Cronkite era. Back then, there was a relatively limited number of broadcast news sources. And you had, for example, you had Cronkite on CBS and Brinkley on NBC. Now, Cronkite turned out to be pretty much a liberal, and Brinkley turned out to be pretty much a conservative, but neither one of them was an idiot. And they weren't going to go on TV and talk about stupid topics and waste everyone's time with a bunch of inanity. And, of course, all the TV guys of that year talk about the fact this was before TV news became a profit center, which was discussed mm-hmm. earlier. I think inevitably the rise of news as a profit center – and I'm assuming that standard narrative is basically accurate, that there was a time in the 60s into the 70s when the networks did not regard the news divisions as profit centers.
They regarded them as prestige, and
right.
they lost money on the evening right. news and made it up somewhere else.
Right.
But everything in American society in the last 40, 50 years has become about profit, consumption, massive wealth. Look around everything in our culture. And that's why this rise in inequality has driven, because the culture has become overwhelmed by the desire for consumption and financial gain. That's what our culture is about. Now, in a way, it wasn't. Oddly enough, it really wasn't like that in the 60s. That's why CEOs didn't demand they make 400 times what the average worker was making back then. So it's all about the desire for profit, I would think. It all goes back to that.
And I'm going to say something which may not make sense in the current climate. It used to be that there were other currencies than money, that money was not the marker of a person, that the prestige of the evening news meant a great deal, that reputation meant a great deal. And now we're in a climate where money is trumping those things.
And absurd amounts of money.
Yes.
I mean, it used to be that, okay, you did well. You did your work hard. You did well.
You had a middle-class life.
You had a middle-class life. You maybe even have a little summer home someplace.
Right.
And that was well.
Right.
Now well is absurd.
Right. For some people.
For some people.
Yeah. For the opinion leaders who really set the tone. When you're paid the amount of money that the people are paid at the top of the press corps, people will do a lot for the amount of money they're being. Rachel Maddow was paid $2 million, according to Newsweek. Now, many liberals are in love with Rachel Maddow. Personally, I'm not. People will do a lot for $2 million. Well, that's peanuts. That's peanuts. And the payoffs that are being held up, not just by Murdoch News, but by other news divisions, obviously they're being paid in part for compliance, to go along with the company, whatever the company's trying to do, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. Obviously, that's part of why they're being paid so much, and people will do a lot for those kind of salaries. $2 million is nothing.
Well, if that's nothing, then I must be kind of scraping the nut inside
you
the shell.
You definitely are.
Well, but that's why we get to say what we're saying right now.
I would hope we wouldn't change if they gave us a bit more money. Would be nice, but anyway, I mean,
try me.
And give it to me, see what happens. But I mean, and what you were saying earlier about your brother made me think about what has happened to the black media as well, which would be a discussion we could have all by itself for an entire
sure.
hour with some people, which we should. I mean, because that has changed. I mean, the black press was the press that was at the forefront, let's say, in the late 50s, early 60s, of the hardest, toughest stories that
sure.
forced the mainstream media
sure.
to deal with segregation. That's all that world's gone. Now it's BET and all the fluff.
Fluff. You really want me to get started?
Yes, at least for 2 minutes.
Well, I mean, the black press, as you said, was, I mean, it was hugely important. And I mean, the civil rights movement, rapes in the South of black women. I mean, there are lots of cases which historians are still unearthing about how the black press helped to change not just black America, but America.
Right.
Black people watch a lot of television, listen to a lot of radio. They used to read. They actually still do read. This is interesting. They still do read more newspapers and magazines. The typical black person still reads more newspaper and magazines than the typical white person.
Which is interesting.
Which is interesting. But they also can generate a lot of income. BET, which was formed by black people, is not anymore owned by black people. It's owned by Viacom. There's a great deal of money in African Americans as what are called style leaders. That there's a certain cool that comes with blackness.
Right.
That so that African Americans take up more of the country's mentality than numbers would suggest, which has been very frustrating for other minorities because these black people are still in the kind of the way. If the audience doesn't know, I am black, so I get to say these things. and so there's a great deal of money there, and. So, BET, and it's very interesting because Sheila Johnson, who is Bob Johnson's former wife, talks about this, where she said she wanted BET to be more of a forum for information and that sort of thing. But the videos were there, and the videos were cheap, and the videos brought in the audience, and she lost that argument for the most part. And that I think, is the microcosm of the argument, is that African Americans are extremely lucrative in terms of fluff leaders, if that makes sense. I, for one, rail because I am very upset that African Americans are spending their moral capital and are wasting their moral capital. I mean, we should be at the forefront of, for instance, the re-abolition of slavery in the United States.
Prisons.
Well, and the slave trade. There's
yes.
the prison slave trade, but there's another slave trade. Who better to be at the forefront of that argument to say never again? Do you see it out there? I don't.
I
mean, I've tried to stir it up. Other people have tried to stir it up. It's not out there. So there's a wasting of that capital because of the tabloidization of black America.
Right.
And that, I think, is very, very dangerous. And I think we are, and I'm going to get phone calls for this. I think we will soon find ourselves largely irrelevant because we have wasted our moment.
You're talking about African media?
African Americans and African American media.
I think we're all irrelevant now. I mean, everyone's irrelevant. Who is relevant anymore unless you're a plutocrat? I mean, the whole American culture and discourse is now run by plutocrats. So if you're not a plutocrat, it doesn't matter what you think or say or who you are or what you believe. It's got nothing to do with it. It's all about shiny objects, distractions, and right-wingism. We haven't really talked too much about Fox's right-wingism, which is probably the most important part of Murdochism for our country. Everyone's overwhelmed now. No one counts. No one is part of anything.
And we should say in the British system, there has never been a sense of objectivity. You would have a right-wing paper and mm-hmm. a left-wing paper, and they would duke it out. What has not happened in the United States is the mounting of an effective left-wing paper.
That's for sure.
Press to duke it out with. I mean, Fox can be there if somebody is willing to oppose them and let the audience figure it out on their own. That's not what is happening in the United States.
We have to end here, but I think that the issue you raise, Sherry, about the African American press and what's happened to that, and also the sense of where the left wing, there is no left wing press to counter what goes on the right and the power of the right in the press, are discussions we should continue and do. And I think that you both raised incredible issues. I want to thank Sherry Parks for coming back to the studios again. It's great to have you here. Guys, this summer break.
Thank you.
In the house, Sherry Parks, author of Fierce Angels, A Strong Black Woman in American Life and Culture, professor of American Studies Department at the University of Maryland, Dr. Sherry Parks, and Bob Sorenby, editor of the Daily Howler, covering the media for many, many years. And I want to thank you both for being here. And you've been listening to The Mark Steiner Show here on 88.9 WEAA, the voice of the community. Stay with us. We're not going anywhere. We'll be back after the top of the hour.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information,
www.mecu.com.